Snow Falling on Cedars, Disc 10.
At 2:35 that afternoon, Ishmael Chambers put his can of kerosene, the heater wick, and two bags of groceries into the trunk of his DeSoto. Tom Torgerson's high school kid had gotten the chains on his tires, and Ishmael, bending low, checked now to see that they were tightly bound. He scraped ice from the DeSoto's windows and ran the defroster before inching out into the snow. The trick, he knew, was to stay off the brake and to keep his traveling speed low and steady, backing off the accelerator at the crests of hills and evenly gaining momentum in the dips. On first hill, he heard his chains, felt them biting, and made his way down cautiously, in first gear, leaning forward in his seat. He did not stop when he got to Main, but turned immediately left instead, skidding a little, in the direction of Center Valley Road. He was less worried now. The snow had compacted under the wheels of other cars. The roads were passable if you were patient and paid attention. His chief concern was not the snow, but other, more careless drivers. It would be important to watch his rearview mirror and to pull over, if that was possible, when he was being gained on. Ishmael took Lundgren Road out of Amity Harbor because it made a steady ascent, without curves or coils, on a grade more reasonable than Mill Run's or Pearsall's, and because it had not been listed on the power company door as blocked by fallen trees. He did see, at George Freeman's place, a Douglas fir that had toppled over so that its root wad now stood 12 feet high beside George's mailbox. The top section of the tree had crushed a piece of George's split-rail cedar fence. George was out there with a chisel-toothed bucksaw, his wool hat perched on top of his balding head, working on it in the storm. Ishmael pushed on down the back side of Lundgren and turned onto Scatter Springs Drive. In the first curve, a Hudson was nosed into a ditch. In the second, a Packard Clipper sedan had flipped onto its roof and sat in the brambles beside the road with its undercarriage facing toward the sky. Ishmael stopped and took photographs of it, setting his tripod on the road verge. The straight lines of the alders and maples behind the Packard, blunt and clean against a sea of snow, the hard grayish quality of the snowstorm light, the forlorn and helpless car itself, with its upturned tires gathering soft mounds of white, its passenger compartment nuzzled into the frozen undergrowth so that only the bottom halves of the windows showed, this was a storm scene if ever there was one. And Ishmael shot it with an eye toward its pathetic aspect, and because it seemed to him to embody what the storm was about, a world in which a Packard Clipper lost its meaning and became unmoored from whatever purpose it originally had. It had no more practical value now than a ship on the bottom of the sea. Ishmael was glad to see that the driver's side window had been rolled down and that no one was still in the car. He thought he recognized it as Charlie Torvalds. Charlie lived on New Sweden Road and made his living building bulkheads and docks and anchoring mooring buoys. He owned a lot of diving equipment, a barge on which a crane had been mounted, and, if Ishmael remembered it right, this rust-brown Packard. Perhaps it would be an embarrassment to him if an image of his upturned car appeared in the pages of the review. Ishmael decided to talk to him about it before going ahead with the photograph. In the third bend in Scatter Springs Drive, a hairpin turn where the road rolled down out of Cedar Woods and onto the brakes over Center Valley, Ishmael saw three men busying themselves with a snowbound Plymouth half in the road. One jumped up and down on its bumper, another squatted and kept an eye on its spinning tires, a third sat behind the wheel with his door thrown open and worked the accelerator. Ishmael threaded past without stopping and swiveled, skidding a little gleefully, his stomach leaping, onto Center Valley Road. An odd enthusiasm for this drive and its dangers had been growing in him ever since he'd left First Hill. The DeSoto, he knew, was a dubious snow car. Ishmael had mounted a cherry wood knob on its steering wheel in order to ease the difficulties driving presented to a man with only one arm. He had changed nothing else, though, and didn't intend to. The DeSoto, strictly an island car for more than a decade, had been purchased by Ishmael's father 15 years before, a four-speed with a semi-automatic transmission, hypoid rear axle, and column shift. Arthur had traded in his Ford Model A plus $500 cash for it in 1939 at a lot in Bellingham. It was a modest vehicle, square and bulky in the manner of a Dodge, so long in front as to look out of balance and with its radiator grille low over the bumper. Ishmael had hung on to it in part from sheer inertia, in part because driving it reminded him of his father. Sitting behind the wheel, he felt his father's contours in the way the seat molded under him. Center Valley's strawberry fields lay under 9 inches of powder and were as fuzzy through the snowfall as a landscape in a dream with no discernible hard edges. On Scatter Springs Drive, the trees had closed the road in so that the sky was little more than an indistinct drab ribbon overhead. But down here, the dramatic expanse of it was visible, chaotic and fierce. Looking out past the windshield wipers, Ishmael saw billions of snowflakes falling in long tangents, driven southward, the sky shrouded and furious. The wind propelled the snow against the sides of barns and homes, and Ishmael could hear it whistling through the wing window's rubber molding, which had been loose now for many years. It had been loose back when his father was alive, one of the car's small idiosyncrasies, part of the reason he was loath to part with it. He passed old Jurgensen's house, where white wood smoke furled from the chimney and disappeared on the wind. Old, apparently, was keeping warm. The snowfall obliterated the borders between the fields and made Kabuo Miyamoto's long-cherished 7 acres indistinguishable from the land that surrounded them. All human claims to the landscape were superseded, made null and void by the snow. The world was one world, and the notion that a man might kill another over some small patch of it did not make sense, though Ishmael knew that such things happened. He had been to war, after all. At the intersection of Center Valley Road and South Beach Drive, Ishmael spied, ahead of him in the bend, a car that had failed to negotiate the grade as it coiled around a grove of snow-hung cedars. Ishmael recognized it as the Willie's station wagon that belonged to Fujiko and Hisao Imada. In fact, Hisao was working with a shovel at its rear right wheel, which had dropped into the roadside drainage ditch. Hisao Imada was small enough most of the time, but he looked even smaller, bundled up in his winter clothes. His hat pulled low and his scarf across his chin, so that only his mouth, nose, and eyes showed. Ishmael knew he would not ask for help, in part because San Pedro people never did, in part because such was his character. Ishmael decided to park at the bottom of the grade beside Gordon Ostrom's mailbox and walk the 50 yards up South Beach Drive, keeping his DeSoto well out of the road while he convinced Hisao Imada to accept a ride from him. Ishmael had known Hisao a long time. When he was 8 years old, he'd seen the Japanese man trudging along behind his sway-backed white plow horse, a Japanese man who carried a machete at his belt in order to cut down vine maples. His family lived in 2 canvas tents while they cleared their newly purchased property. They drew water from a feeder creek and warmed themselves at a slash pile kept burning by his children, girls in rubber boots, including Hatsue, who dragged branches and brought armfuls of brush to it. Hisao was lean and tough and worked methodically, never altering his pace. He wore a shoulder-strap T-shirt, and this, coupled with the sharp-honed weapon at his belt, put Ishmael in mind of the pirates he'd read about in illustrated books his father had brought him from the Amity Harbor Public Library. But all of this was more than 20 years ago now. So that as he approached Hisao Imada in the South Beach Drive, Ishmael saw the man in another light, hapless, small in the storm, numb with the cold and ineffective with his shovel while the trees threatened to come down around him. Ishmael saw something else, too. On the far side of the car, with her own shovel in hand, Hatsue worked without looking up. She was digging through the snow to the black earth of the cedar woods and throwing spadefuls of it underneath the tires. 15 minutes later, the three of them walked down the road toward his DeSoto. The Willie's station wagon's rear right tire had been perforated by a fallen branch, still wedged up under both axles. The rear length of exhaust pipe had been crushed, too. The car wasn't going anywhere. Ishmael could see that. But it took Esau some time to accept this truth. With his shovel, he'd struggled defiantly, as if the tool could indeed change the car's fate. After 10 minutes of polite assistance, Ishmael wondered aloud if his DeSoto wasn't the answer, and persisted in this vein for 5 minutes more before Esau yielded to it as an unavoidable evil. He opened his car door, put in his shovel, and came out with a bag of groceries and a gallon of kerosene. Hatsue, for her part, went on with her digging, saying nothing and keeping to the far side of the car and throwing black earth beneath the tires. At last, her father rounded the Willies and spoke to her once in Japanese. She stopped her work and came into the road then, and Ishmael was granted a good look at her. He had spoken to her only the morning before in the second-floor hallway of the Island County Courthouse, where she'd sat on a bench with her back to an arched window just outside the assessor's office. Her hair had been woven then, as now, into a black knot against the nape of her neck. She'd told him 4 times to go away. "Hello, Hatsue," said Ishmael. "I can give you a lift home if you want." "My father says he's accepted," Hatsue replied. "He says he's grateful for your help." She followed her father and Ishmael down the hill, still carrying her shovel to the DeSoto. When they were well on their way down South Beach Drive, easing through the flats along the saltwater, Esau explained in broken English that his daughter was staying with him during the trial. Ishmael could drop them at his house. Then he described how a branch had hurled down into the road in front of him. To avoid it, he'd hit his brake pedal. The Willies had fishtailed while it climbed the snapped branch and nudged down into the drainage ditch. Only once, driving and listening, nodding politely and inserting small exclamations of interest, I see, yes, of course, I can understand," did Ishmael risk looking at Hatsue Miyamoto in the rectangle of his rearview mirror, a risk that filled all of 2 seconds. He saw then that she was staring out the side window with enormous deliberation, with intense concentration on the world outside his car. She was making it a point to be absorbed by the storm, and that her black hair was wringing wet with snow. 2 strands had escaped from their immaculate arrangement and lay pasted against her frozen cheek. "I know it's caused you trouble," Ishmael said, "but don't you think the snow is beautiful? Isn't it beautiful coming down?" The boughs in the fir trees hung heavy with it. The fence rails and mailboxes wore mantles of it. The road before him lay filled with it, and there was no sign anywhere of people. Hisao Imada agreed that it was so. "Ah, yes, beautiful," he commented softly. And at the same moment, his daughter turned swiftly forward so that her eyes met Ishmael's in the mirror. It was the cryptic look, he recognized, that she'd aimed at him fleetingly on the second floor of the courthouse when he'd tried to speak to her before her husband's trial. Ishmael still could not read what her eyes meant. Punishment, sorrow, perhaps buried anger, perhaps all 3 simultaneously. Perhaps some sort of disappointment. For the life of him, after all these years, he couldn't read the expression on her face. If Hisao wasn't present, he told himself, he'd ask her flat out what she was trying to say by looking at him with such detached severity and saying nothing at all. What, after all, had he done to her? What had she to be angry about? The anger, he thought, ought to be his own. Yet years ago now, the anger about her had finished, gradually bleeding out of him, and had slowly dried up and blown away. Nothing had replaced it either. He had not found anything to take its place. When he saw her, as he sometimes did, in the aisles of Peterson's grocery or on the street in Amity Harbor, he turned away from seeing her with just a little less hurry than she turned away from seeing him. They avoided one another rigorously. It had come to him one day, 3 years before, how immersed she was in her own existence. She'd knelt in front of Fisk's hardware center, tying her daughter's shoelaces in bows, her purse on the sidewalk beside her. She hadn't known he was watching. He'd seen her kneeling and working on her daughter's shoes, and it had come to him what her life was. She was a married woman with children. She slept in the same bed every night with Kabuo Miyamoto. He had taught himself to forget as best he could. The only thing left was a vague sense of waiting for Hatsue, a fantasy to return to him. How exactly this might be achieved, he could not begin to imagine. But he could not keep himself from feeling that he was waiting and that these years were only an interim between other years he had passed and would pass again with Hatsue. She spoke now from the back seat, having turned again to look out the window. "Your newspaper," she said. That was all. "Yes," answered Ishmael. "I'm listening." "The trial, Kabuo's trial, is unfair," said Hatsue. "You should talk about that in your newspaper."
"What's unfair?" asked Ishmael. "What exactly is unfair? I'll be happy to write about it if you'll tell me."
She was still staring out the window at the snow, with strands of wet hair pasted against her cheek. "It's all unfair," she told him bitterly. "Kabuo didn't kill anyone. It isn't in his heart to kill anyone. They brought in that sergeant to say he's a killer. That was just prejudice. Did you hear the things that man was saying? How Kabuo had it in his heart to kill? How horrible he is, a killer? Put it in your paper about that man's testimony, how all of it was unfair, how the whole trial is unfair."
"I understand what you mean," answered Ishmael, "but I'm not a legal expert. I don't know if the judge should have suppressed Sergeant Maples' testimony, but I hope the jury comes in with the right verdict. I could write a column about that, maybe. How we all hope the justice system does its job, how we hope for an honest result."
"There shouldn't even be a trial," said Hatsue. "The whole thing is wrong. It's wrong."
"I'm bothered, too, when things are unfair," Ishmael said to her. "But sometimes I wonder if unfairness isn't part of things. I wonder if we should even expect fairness. If we should assume we have some sort of right to it, or if..."
"I'm not talking about the whole universe," cut in Hatsue. "I'm talking about people. The sheriff, that prosecutor, the judge, you. People who can do things because they run newspapers or arrest people or convict them or decide about their lives. People don't have to be unfair, do they? That isn't just part of things when people are unfair to somebody."
"No, it isn't," Ishmael replied coldly. "You're right. People don't have to be unfair."
When he let them out beside the Yamato's mailbox, he felt that somehow he had gained the upper hand. He had an emotional advantage. He had spoken with her, and she had spoken back, wanting something from him. She'd volunteered a desire. The strain between them, the hostility he felt, it was better than nothing, he decided. It was an emotion of some sort they shared. He sat in the DeSoto and watched Hatsue trudge away through the falling snow, carrying her shovel on her shoulder. It occurred to him that her husband was going out of her life in the same way he himself once had. There had been circumstances then, and there were circumstances now. They were things beyond anyone's control. Neither he nor Hatsue had wanted the war to come. Neither of them had wanted that intrusion. But now her husband was accused of murder. And that changed things between them. Chapter 23. The Coast Guard lighthouse on the rocks at Point White was a tower built out of reinforced concrete that rose 100 feet above the sea. In the 30 years before it went up, 11 ships came aground at the point. 2 mail steamers, 7 timber schooners, a Norwegian freighter, and a 4-masted bark with a cargo of Newcastle coal on board, inbound for Seattle in a windstorm. There was no sign of them at all anymore. They'd broken up and, over the years, washed away into the ocean. There was only a jumble of barnacle-encrusted sea rock and a view of the water stretching to the horizon, unbroken, gray, and blurred in the distance at the place where the ocean and the sky met. On occasions when the tide ran exceptionally high, waves washed perilously close to the lighthouse, dashing its base with salt-tinged algae, which clung to it now like sea moss. Underneath the lighthouse's copper dome lay 16 reflecting prisms and 4 projecting lenses floating in a bath of mercury. The Coast Guard kept the clockworks greased, and the lenses revolved twice each minute. And yet there were still accidents, despite everything. There seemed no way to prevent them. In a thick fog, the light could not be seen, and boats continued to come aground. The Coast Guard installed sounding boards along island beaches and anchored numbered buoys at intervals in the shipping channel, and these measures seemed sufficient to islanders until the next accident came along. A tug towing a diesel ferry from San Francisco broke up on the rocks a mile to the north. Then a tug towing a barge full of peeler logs, then a salvage steamer working out of Victoria. News of such wrecks was received by islanders with a grim brand of determinism. It seemed to many that such things were ordained by God, or, at any rate, unavoidable. They came out in large numbers in the aftermath of a shipwreck to stand on the beach and stare in awe at the latest foundering vessel. Some brought binoculars and cameras. Old fishermen with time on their hands built bonfires out of driftwood and warmed themselves while the sea made breaches in the hulls of ships that had come hard aground. There was much discussion and finger-pointing. Working without a single hard fact, islanders drew a variety of conclusions. Pilot error, pilot inexperience, misread charts, crossed signals, fog, wind, tide, ineptitude. When after days a ship broke apart, or the pieces of it sank, or a salvage company gave up in despair after offloading 1/25th of its cargo, islanders watched blankly with their mouths hard set and shook their heads once or twice. For a week or so they spoke cautiously of what they'd seen, and then it faded out of the realm of the discourse they shared together. They thought of it only at private moments. Ishmael Chambers, in the last light of day, found himself seated in the office of the lighthouse chief petty officer, a large man named Evan Powell. The place was lit by kerosene lanterns and heated by a cast-iron wood stove. Outside, a generator powered the lighthouse so that each 30 seconds the beacon flashed against the glass of the office window. Petty Officer Powell kept an immaculate desk, a calendar blotter, 2 upright pen stands, a nearly full ashtray, a telephone. He sat back in a reclining desk chair, with a lit cigarette between his fingers, scratching his face and coughing.
"I've got a cold," he explained to Ishmael hoarsely. "I'm not firing on every cylinder right now, but I'll help you out if I can, Mr. Chambers. You need something for your newspaper?"
"I do," said Ishmael. "I'm putting an article together on this storm. I'm wondering if you have archives of some kind. Weather records from way back, maybe? Something I could take a look at? Go through old logs, something like that, try to make some comparisons. I can't remember a storm like this one, but that doesn't mean it never happened."
"We do a lot of record-keeping," Petty Officer Powell replied. "The lighthouse has been here longer than the Coast Guard. I don't know how far back there's reliable information. Anyway, you can have a look if you want. There's more stuff around than you'd ever want to get into. I'd be interested in seeing what you find out.
Petty Officer Powell fell forward in his chair and carefully snubbed out his cigarette. He picked up the telephone and, dialing a single number, drew a handkerchief out of his pocket.
"Who's this?" he said gruffly into the receiver. "I want you to see if you can find Levant. Find Levant and tell him to come down here. Tell him to bring a couple kerosene lanterns. Tell him I need him right away."
He put his hand over the receiver mouth, blew his nose, and looked at Ishmael.
"How much time you got?" he said. "I can spare Levant to help you out for a couple of hours, tops."
"That's all right," said Ishmael. "I don't want to trouble anybody here. Just point me in the right direction." Evan Powell slipped his hand from the receiver.
"Smoltz," he said. "Get Levant. Tell him I need him right away. Find Levant for this."
He hung up and blew his nose one more time.
"There's no shipping in this weather," he said. "We raised Nia Bay an hour ago. We figured the snow isn't going to let up until tomorrow afternoon."
The radio man named Levant arrived. Levant was tall enough to be a basketball player, 6'5 or 6'6, with a large Adam's apple and tightly curled black hair, and he carried a lantern and a flashlight.
"This man here is Ishmael Chambers," Petty Officer Powell explained. "He runs a newspaper down in town and needs to take a look into our weather records. I want you to set things up for him, get him squared away, help him out, give him what he needs, set him up a couple lanterns."
"Anything else?" Levant said.
"Don't miss your radio watch over it," Powell said. "There's 2 hours before you're on."
"Listen," said Ishmael, "just point me in the right direction. I don't want to take anybody's time." Levant led the way to the records room on the second floor, which was stacked floor to ceiling with wooden crates, file cabinets, and duffel bags. It smelled of brittle paper and of mimeograph ink and had not been dusted recently.
"Everything's dated," Levant pointed out, finding a place for a lantern. "That's how we do things, by dates mainly. Radio transmissions, shipping log, weather reports, maintenance. Everything's in here by date, I guess. There's a date on everything."
"You have a radio watch?" Ishmael asked. "Are you the radio man?"
"I am now," Levant said. "I have been for the last couple of months or so. Last guys got transferred. I moved up."
"Is there a lot of record-keeping with your job? Does a radio man contribute to all of this?"
"There's a guy shorthands all the radio transmissions," Levant explained to him. "He writes them up, files them. They end up here in a cabinet. And that's all they're good for, seems like. They just take up space is all. No one pays any attention."
Ishmael picked up a manila folder and turned it toward the lantern light.
"Looks like I'm going to be a while," he said. "Why don't you go about your business? If I need something, I can find you."
"I'll bring another lantern," Levant replied.
He was alone then, with the fog of his breath in the lantern light and the crates of maritime records. The room smelled of salt water and snow and of the past. It was full of the scent of lost days. Ishmael tried to concentrate on his work, but the image of Hatsue in the backseat of his car, her eyes meeting his in the rearview mirror, carried him away into his memories. The first time he'd seen her after the war, she'd tried, he recalled, to be amiable. But he had not been capable of accepting this. He'd stood behind her with his milk and crackers, waiting in line at Peterson's. He'd stood in silence, hating her. And she'd turned toward him with a baby on her shoulder and said with a detached formality that she was very sorry to have heard about his arm, how he had lost it in the war. She was, he remembered, as beautiful as ever, a little older and harder around the eyes, and it hurt him to look at her face and at her hair, which she wore in a braid down her back. Ishmael stood there looking pale and ill. He had a cold and a mild fever. With the sleeve of his Mackinaw coat pinned up, his milk and crackers clutched in his hand, and stared long and hard at Hatsue's baby, while the grocery checker, Eleanor Hill, pretended not to notice that Hatsue had spoken of what others, including Eleanor, would not acknowledge, that Ishmael was missing an arm. "The Japs did it," Ishmael said flatly, still staring hard at the baby. "They shot my arm off. Japs." Hatsue looked at him a moment longer, then turned toward Eleanor Hill again and opened up her coin purse.
"I'm sorry," said Ishmael immediately. "I didn't mean that. I didn't mean what I said."
But she showed no sign of having heard. And so he put down the crackers and milk and put his hand on her shoulder.
"I'm sorry,"
he said a second time, but she still didn't turn to look at him. And she moved away from his hand.
"I'm more than sorry. I'm miserable. Do you understand? I don't mean what I say. You can't trust me when I speak anymore. I just say things. I..."
Eleanor Hill was pretending busily that Ishmael, a war veteran, wasn't standing in her presence, speaking the words he was speaking. It was what he'd gotten when he spoke about himself, when he'd tried to say what he had to say. There was nothing he could easily explain to anyone, and nobody who wanted to listen. There were other boys who had been to the war, and he found that on occasion he could speak to them, but that didn't mean anything.
"I'm sorry, Hatsue," he said one more time. "I'm sorry about everything, all of it."
He'd left without buying the milk and crackers. He went home and wrote an apologetic letter, explaining at length that he was not himself, that he sometimes said what he did not mean, that he wished he had never said Jap in front of her, that he would never do so again. The letter sat in his desk drawer for 2 weeks before he threw it away. Despite himself, he knew where she lived and which car she drove. And when he saw her husband, Kabuo Miyamoto, he felt something tighten around his heart. He felt himself grow tight inside. And for a long time he could not sleep at night. He would lie awake until 2 o'clock in the morning, then turn a light on and attempt to read from a book or magazine. Gradually, dawn came, and he would not have slept. He would go out to wander the island's trails in the early morning at a slow pace. Once, so doing, he came across her. She was down on the beach at Fletcher's Bay, raking for steamer clams busily. Her baby slept on a blanket beside her, underneath an umbrella. Ishmael had come up the beach deliberately and squatted beside Hatsue while she raked clams free and dropped them into a bucket.
"Hatsue," he'd pleaded, "can I talk to you?"
"I'm married," she'd said, without looking at him. "It isn't right for us to be alone. It will look bad, Ishmael. People will talk."
"There's no one here," answered Ishmael. "I've got to talk to you, Hatsue. You owe me that much, don't you? Don't you think you do?"
"Yes," said Hatsue. "I do." She turned away from him and looked at her baby. The sun had crept up onto the child's face. Hatsue adjusted the beach umbrella.
"I'm like a dying person," Ishmael said to her. "I haven't been happy for a single moment since the day you left for Manzanar. It's like carrying a weight around in my gut, a ball of lead or something. Do you know how that feels, Hatsue? Sometimes I think I'm going to go crazy, end up in the hospital in Bellingham. I'm crazy. I don't sleep. I'm up all night. It never leaves me alone, this feeling. Sometimes I don't think I can stand it. I tell myself this can't go on, but it goes on anyway. There isn't anything I can do."
Hatsue pushed the hair from her eyes with the back of her left wrist. "I'm sorry for you," she said softly. "I don't want your unhappiness. I never meant for you to suffer. But I don't know what I can do for you now. I don't know how I can help you."
"You'll think this is crazy," Ishmael said. "But all I want is to hold you. All I want is just to hold you once and smell your hair, Hatsue. I think after that I'll be better."
Hatsue had looked at him hard for a long moment, the clamming rake clutched in her hand.
"Look," she said, "you know I can't. I can never touch you, Ishmael. Everything has to be over between us. We both have to put it all behind us and go on, live our lives. There's no halfway, from my point of view. I'm married, I have a baby, and I can't let you hold me. So what I want you to do right now is get up and walk away from here and forget about me forever. You have to let go of me, Ishmael."
"I know you're married," Ishmael had said.
I want to forget about you. I do. I think if you hold me, I can start, Hatsue. Hold me once, and I'll walk away and never speak to you again.
No, she'd said. It can't be. You'll have to find some other way. I'm not going to hold you, ever.
I'm not talking about love, he said. I'm not asking you to try to love me, but just as one human being to another, just because I'm miserable and don't know where to turn, I just need to be in your arms.
Hatsue sighed and turned her eyes from his.
Go away, she'd said. I hurt for you, I honestly do. I feel terrible for your misery, but I'm not going to hold you, Ishmael. You're going to have to live without holding me. Now get up and leave me alone. Please.
The years had passed. And now her husband was on trial for the murder of a man at sea. It dawned on Ishmael in the Coast Guard record room that perhaps something pertinent to Kabuo's case could be found right here among these files. And suddenly, he put aside his weather records and began to search the cabinets. And a strange excitement grew in him. It took Ishmael all of 15 minutes to find what it was he wanted. It was in a file cabinet to the right of the door, near the front of the third drawer down, records for September 15th and 16th of 1954. No wind, moderate tides, thick fog, balmy. One ship through at 0120 hours, the SS West Corona, Greek-owned Liberian flag. She'd called in her position from out to the west, headed southbound toward Seattle. The radio transmissions were in shorthand. The Corona had put in a call from northwest of sounding board 56, looking for a fix from the lighthouse radio signal. She'd come down the strait plotting soundings as she went, but the pilot would not put his faith in this, and at 0126 hours that morning, in heavy fog, had radioed the lighthouse for assistance. There was interference, and the signal was weak, so the radio man on duty had advised the Corona's navigator to take a reading off sounding board 56, which lay on the north shore of Lanhedron Island, and to plot his position accordingly. The Corona's navigator had ordered a whistle blast and timed the interval of the echo. He did his division and his multiplication and relayed his position to the radio man. The Corona was out of the lane, he reported, somewhere south of buoy 56, and would have to dogleg to the northeast, bisecting Ship Channel Bank. Ship Channel Bank. Where Dale Middleton, Vance Cope, and Leonard George had all seen Carlina with his net out on the night he went into the sea. On that night, an enormous freighter had plowed right through the fishing grounds, throwing before it a wake large enough to knock even a big man overboard. At 0142, on pilot's orders, the Corona made its corrective dogleg while the navigator fixed twice more on the sounding board. Later, the navigator took three more insurance readings, boards 58, 59, and 60. It seemed to the Corona's radio man that they were safely back in the shipping lane. In the vicinity of White Sand Bay, he picked up the lighthouse's radio beacon and, gaining confidence by the moment, made the big swing to the south. The Corona locked onto the lighthouse radio signal and made headway for Seattle. Everything was in triplicate. Military standard carbon copies. They were signed by the radio man's assistant, a seaman, Philip Milholland. He'd transcribed the radio transmissions. Ishmael slipped three center pages of seaman Milholland's notes free and folded them into quarters. The pages fit neatly into his coat pocket, and he let them sit there, feeling them, composing himself a little. Then he grabbed one of the lanterns and went out. At the bottom of the stairs, in an anteroom, he found Levant slowly paging through the Saturday Evening Post beside a kerosene floor heater. "I'm done," he pointed out. There's just one more thing. Is Philip Milholland around somewhere? I want to talk to him.
Levant shook his head and put the magazine on the floor.
You know Milholland?
He said.
Sort of, said Ishmael. An acquaintance. Milholland's gone. He got transferred out to Cape Flattery, Milholland and Robert Miller. That's when we moved up.
We? Asked Ishmael. Who's we?
Me and Smoltz, the two of us. We started in together. Smoltz.
When was that? When did Milholland leave?
That was back in September, said Levant. Me and Smoltz started in September 16th as Dog Watch radio team.
Dog Watch? Like at night?
Night shift, yes, Levant said. Me and Smoltz work the night shift.
So Milholland's gone, said Ishmael. He left September 15th?
He couldn't have left the 15th, said Levant, because he worked the night of the 15th. So he must have left on the 16th. That's it. He and Miller went out to Flattery the 16th of September.
Nobody knows, thought Ishmael. The men who'd heard the Corona's radio transmissions had gone somewhere else the next day. They'd done their watch on the night of the 15th, slept through the morning of the 16th, and then they'd left San Pedro. The transcribed transmissions had gone into a manila folder, and the folder had gone into a file cabinet in a room stuffed full of Coast Guard records. And who would find them there? They were as good as lost forever, it seemed to Ishmael. And no one knew the truth of the matter. That on the night Carl Heine had drowned, stopping his watch at 1:47, a freighter plowed through Ship Channel Bank at 1:42, just 5 minutes earlier. No doubt throwing before it a wall of water big enough to founder a small gill-netting boat and toss even a big man overboard. Or rather, one person, he himself, knew this truth. That was the heart of it.
Chapter 24. Ishmael's mother had the wood stove in the kitchen going. He could see the smoke rising thick from the chimney, a ghostly white against the hard-falling snow, and was standing at the sink in her overcoat and scarf when Ishmael passed in front of her window carrying his can of kerosene. A fog of condensation had formed on the inside of the pane, so that her image appeared to him as a kind of silhouette, a vague impression of his mother at the sink, refracted and fragmented, a wash of color. As he passed by, peering through the window mist and snowfall, he saw her hand work with sudden clarity to wipe a circle of the pane dry, and then her eye met his and she waved. Ishmael held up the can of kerosene, still moving steadily toward the kitchen door. His mother had shoveled clear a path to the woodshed, but the snowfall was already covering it. Her shovel stood propped against the fence railing. He stood in the kitchen doorway, set the kerosene down, and felt the place in his coat pocket where Philip Milholland's Coast Guard notes lay, folded against his leg. He took his hand out, and then returned it and touched the notes again. Then he picked up the kerosene and went in. His mother had on rubber boots, unbuckled, and had used small finishing nails to tack a wool blanket across the entry to the living room. The light in the kitchen came opaquely through the wet windows. The room was warm, and on the table, neatly arranged, lay a collection of candles, a kerosene lantern, two flashlights, and a box of wooden matches. His mother had set a soup kettle full of snow on the wood stove. It hissed and snapped as Ishmael shut the door behind him. "I've got some food in the car," he said, setting the can of kerosene against the wall, "and a new wick for the heater." He put it on the table beside the candles. "Did you freeze last night?" he asked.
"Not at all," replied his mother. "I'm really glad to see you, Ishmael. I tried to call, but the phone is out. The lines must all be down."
"They are," said Ishmael, "everywhere." She finished pouring snow-melt water from a second kettle into jugs in the sink, then dried her hands and turned to him.
"Are people stranded?" she said.
"I must have seen 50 cars along the roads between here and town," said Ishmael. "I saw Charlie Torval's car upside down and the Blackberry stickers up on Scatter Springs. Trees are down all over the place. There's no power anywhere.
They're trying to get town back up by morning. They're doing town first, like always. If they do get it lit again, you should come stay with me. We'll shut this place up and move to town. There's no need to stay out here and freeze to death.
I'm not freezing, his mother said, pulling the scarf from her head. In fact, it's a little too hot just now. I just got done shoveling and bringing stove wood around. I'm perfectly comfortable except for my worry about what's going to happen when the plumbing thaws out. The last thing I need is a burst pipe.
We'll open the taps, answered Ishmael. You shouldn't have any problems. There's a pressure valve in the line on the east wall in the cellar. Dad put it in, remember?
He sat down at the table and cupped the stump of his amputated arm in his hand, then rubbed and squeezed it gently.
Thing aches when it gets this cold, he said.
It's 12 degrees, said his mother. Are those groceries up in your car going to freeze? Maybe we should go for them.
All right, said Ishmael. Let's.
When your arm is ready, said his mother. They brought the 2 bags of groceries down, as well as Ishmael's camera. His mother's flower beds were all covered over, and the snow was lining up on her holly trees and mulberry and frosting the tops of her rhododendrons. She was, she said, worried about her flowers, whether the less hardy of them would survive the freeze. She'd lost flowers in lesser weather, she pointed out. Ishmael saw where she had worked with the wheelbarrow at bringing cordwood from the shed to the kitchen door. There were splinters around the wood block where she'd cut kindling. His mother, at 56, was the sort of country widow who lives alone quite capably. He knew that she rose at 4:15 every morning, made her bed, fed her chickens, showered, dressed, cooked herself a poached egg and toast, steeped strong tea and sipped it at the table, then got immediately at her breakfast dishes and whatever housework needed doing. By 9 o'clock, he speculated, there was nothing left she felt obligated to do, and so she read, or tended her flowers, or drove in to Peterson's grocery. It was unclear to him, though, exactly how she passed her time. He knew she read incessantly, Shakespeare, Henry James, Dickens, Thomas Hardy. But he did not think this could fill her days. On Wednesday evenings, twice a month, she attended a meeting of her book circle, 5 other women who enjoyed discussing Benito Cereno, Flowers of Evil, The Importance of Being Earnest, and Jane Eyre. She was on friendly terms with Lillian Taylor, with whom she shared a passion for flowers and for the Magic Mountain and Mrs. Dalloway. The two of them would stoop or stand in the garden, picking the seeds from the feathery spires of astilbes a few weeks past their prime, then sit at a garden table shaking the seeds clean and collecting them in small manila packets. They drank lemon-scented water and ate sandwiches with the crusts cut off at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. "We're dainty old ladies," he heard Lillian exclaim once. "We'll wear painter smocks and blue berets and do watercolors next. What do you say to that, Helen? Are you ready to be an old biddy with her paints?" Helen Chambers was homely and dignified in the manner of Eleanor Roosevelt. Her homeliness composed a form of beauty. She was quite impressive to look at. Her nose was broad and her forehead stately. For her shopping trips to town, she wore a camel's hair coat and a boater festooned with ribbon and striped lace. Her husband's death had inspired in her a greater attentiveness to her books and flowers and a greater need for people. Ishmael had stood beside her at church while she greeted her friends and acquaintances with the sort of cordiality and genuine feeling he couldn't muster in himself. Often he ate lunch with her afterward. He had explained to his mother when she asked him to say grace that, like his father before him, he was an incorrigible agnostic and suspected God was a hoax.
"Suppose you had to choose right now," his mother had once replied. "Supposing somebody put a gun to your head and forced you to choose, Ishmael, is there a God or isn't there?"
"Nobody has a gun to my head," Ishmael had answered her. "I don't have to choose, do I? That's the whole point. I don't have to know for certain one way or the other if—"
"Nobody knows, Ishmael. What do you believe?"
"I don't believe anything. It isn't in me. Besides, I don't know what you mean by God. If you tell me what he is, Mom, I'll tell you if I think he exists."
"Everybody knows what God is," said his mother. "You feel what God is, don't you?"
"I don't feel what God is," answered Ishmael.
I don't feel anything either way. No feeling about it comes to me. It's not something I have a choice about. Isn't a feeling like that supposed to happen? Isn't it just supposed to happen? I can't make a feeling like that up, can I? Maybe God just chooses certain people, and the rest of us, we can't feel him.
You felt him as a child, his mother said. I remember, Ishmael, you felt him.
That was a long time ago, Ishmael answered. What a child feels, that's different.
Now, in the twilight, he sat in the kitchen of his mother's house with Philip Milholland's notes in his coat pocket and tried to feel that intimation of God he had felt as a younger person. It was not something he could conjure up again. After the war, he had tried to feel God, to take solace in him. It hadn't worked, and he had dismissed the attempt when he could no longer ignore that it felt like a pathetic falsehood. The wind shuddered against the window behind him, and the snow outside fell fast. His mother had a soup they could eat, she said, 5 kinds of beans, onions, and celery, a ham shank, 2 small turnips. Was he hungry now, or did he want to wait? She was happy either way. She could eat or not eat. It didn't matter to her. Ishmael pushed 2 slabs of fir heartwood into the fire in the cook stove. He put a kettle of water on, then sat down again at the table. It's plenty warm in here, he pointed out. You don't have to worry about getting cold.
Stay, replied his mother. Spend the night. I've got 3 extra comforters. Your room will be cold, but your bed should be fine. Don't go back out into all of that snow. Stay and be comfortable.
He agreed to stay, and she put the soup on. In the morning, he would see about printing his newspaper. For now, he was warm where he was. Ishmael sat with his hand in his coat pocket and wondered if he shouldn't just tell his mother about the Coast Guard notes he had stolen from the lighthouse and then drive carefully back into town to hand the notes over to Judge Fielding. But he did nothing. He sat watching the twilight fade beyond the kitchen windows.
That murder trial, his mother said finally. I suppose you've been busy with that.
It's all I think about, said Ishmael.
It's a shame, said his mother. I have to think it's a travesty that they arrested him because he's Japanese.
Ishmael made no reply to this. His mother lit one of the candles on the table and placed a saucer under it.
What do you think? She asked him. I haven't been there listening, so I'm interested in what you have to say.
I've covered every minute, Ishmael answered. And he felt himself growing cold now, and the depth of his coldness was not a surprise. And he closed his hand around Milholland's notes.
I have to think he's guilty, lied Ishmael. The evidence is very solidly against him. The prosecutor has a good case.
He explained to her about the blood on the fishing gaff, the wound on the left side of Karl Heine's head, the sergeant who had testified that Kabuo Miyamoto was an expert when it came to killing with a stick. He told her about old Jurgensen's testimony and the long dispute over land. He told her how 3 different fishermen had reported seeing Kabuo Miyamoto fishing near Karl Heine on the night the murder happened, and he told her about the length of mooring rope. The accused man sat so rigorously in his chair, so unmovable and stolid. He did not appear remorseful. He did not turn his head or move his eyes, nor did he change his expression. He seemed to Ishmael proud and defiant and detached from the possibility of his own death by hanging. It reminded him, he told his mother, of a training lecture he'd listened to at Paris Island. The Japanese soldier, a colonel had explained, would die fighting before he would surrender. His allegiance to his country and his pride in being Japanese prevented him from giving in. He was not averse to dying at war in the way Americans were. He did not have the same feeling about death on the battlefield that American soldiers felt. To the Japanese soldier, a life in defeat was not for a moment worth living. He knew he could not return to his people, having suffered the humiliation of losing.
he could not meet his maker afterward either. His religion demanded he die with honor. Understand, the colonel added, the Jap preferred to die with honor intact. And in this, the infantryman should indulge him. In other words, take no prisoners. Shoot first and ask questions later. The enemy, you see, has no respect for life, his own or anyone else's. He doesn't play by the rules. He'll put up his hands, pretend to surrender, and all the while he's rigged himself to booby-trap as you approach. It's characteristic of the Jap to be sly and treacherous. He won't show what he's thinking in his face.
It was all propaganda, added Ishmael. They wanted us to be able to kill them with no remorse, to make them less than people. None of it is fair or true. But at the same time, I find myself thinking about it whenever I look at Miyamoto sitting there staring straight ahead. They could have used his face for one of their propaganda films. He's that inscrutable.
I know who he is, said Ishmael's mother. He's a striking man. His face is powerful. Like you, Ishmael, he's served in the war. Have you forgotten that he fought in the war? That he risked his life for this country?
All right, said Ishmael. He served. Is that a fact pertinent to the murder of Karl Heine? Is it relevant to the case at hand? I grant you the man is striking, as you say, and that he served in the war. Are those things relevant?
I don't understand what makes them relevant. They're at least as relevant as your propaganda lecture, Ishmael's mother replied. If you're going to remember something like that and connect it in some way to the defendant's expression, well then, you'd better be remembering other things too, just to keep yourself fair. Otherwise, you're being subjective in a way that is not at all fair to the accused. You're allowing yourself an imbalance.
The defendant's expression isn't part of it, said Ishmael. Impressions aren't part of it. Feelings aren't part of it. The facts are all that matter, said Ishmael. And the facts weigh in against him.
You said yourself the trial isn't over, Ishmael's mother pointed out. The defense hasn't made its case yet, but you're all ready to convict. You've got the prosecutor's set of facts, but that might not be the whole story. It never is, Ishmael. And besides, really, facts are so cold, so horribly cold. Can we depend on facts? By themselves?
What else do we have? Replied Ishmael. Everything else is ambiguous. Everything else is emotions and hunches. At least the facts you can cling to. The emotions just float away.
Float away with them, said his mother. If you can remember how, Ishmael. If you can find them again. If you haven't gone cold forever.
She got up and went to the wood stove. He sat in silence, with his forehead in his hand, breathing through his nose and suddenly empty. A great airy space had blown up inside of him, a bubble of ether expanding against his ribcage. He was empty now, emptier than he had been just a moment earlier, before his mother had spoken. What did she know about the vast region of emptiness that inhabited him all of the time? What did she know about him, anyway? It was one thing for her to have known him as a child. It was another for her to come to terms with the nature of his adult wounds. She didn't know, finally. He couldn't explain himself. He did not want to explain to her his coldness or reveal himself in any way. He had watched her, after all, mourn her husband's death, and it had been for her, in part, the discovery that grief could attach itself with permanence, something Ishmael had already discovered. It attached itself, and then it burrowed inside and made a nest and stayed. It ate whatever was warm nearby, and then the coldness settled in permanently. You learn to live with it.
His mother had gone cold when Arthur died. Her grief for him was fixed. But this had not stopped her from taking pleasure in life, it now occurred to Ishmael. There she stood at the stove, ladling soup with the calm ease of one who feels there is certainly such a thing as grace. She took pleasure in the soup's smell, in the heat of the wood stove, in the shadow of herself the candlelight now cast against the kitchen wall. The room had gone dark and tranquil now. The one warm place in all the world. And he felt empty in it. "I'm unhappy," he said. "Tell me what to do." His mother made no reply at first. Instead, she came to the table with his bowl of soup and set it down in front of him. She brought her own bowl to the table, too, and then a loaf of bread on a cutting board and a dish of creamery butter and spoons. "You're unhappy," she said, seating herself. She put her elbows down on the table and rested her chin against her palms. "That you are unhappy, I have to say, is the most obvious thing in the world." "Tell me what to do," repeated Ishmael. "Tell you what to do?" his mother said. "I can't tell you what to do, Ishmael. I've tried to understand what it's been like for you, having gone to war, having lost your arm, not having married or had children. I've tried to make sense of it all, believe me, I have, how it must feel to be you. But I must confess that no matter how I try, I can't really understand you. There are other boys, after all, who went to war and came back home and pushed on with their lives. They found girls and married and had children and raised families despite whatever was behind them. But you went numb, Ishmael. And you've stayed numb all these years. And I haven't known what to do or say about it or how I might help you in some way. I've prayed and I've talked to Pastor.
There were guys who prayed at Tarawa, said Ishmael. They still got killed, Mother. Just like the guys who didn't pray. It didn't matter either way.
But just the same, I've prayed for you. I've wanted you to be happy, Ishmael. But I haven't known what to do.
They ate their soup and bread in silence, while the kettle on the wood stove hissed. The candle on the table cast an arc of light across their food. And outside, through the misty window pane, the snow on the ground caught the moonlight beyond the clouds and held it so that it suffused everything. Ishmael tried to enjoy the small pleasures of warmth and light and bread. He did not want to tell his mother about Hatsue Miyamoto and how he had, many years ago, felt certain they would be married. He did not want to tell her about the hollow cedar tree where they'd met so many times. He had never told anybody about those days. He had worked hard to forget them. Now the trial had brought all of that back. "Your father fought at Belleau Wood," his mother told him suddenly. "It took him years to get over it. He had nightmares and he suffered just as you do. But it didn't stop him from living."
"He didn't get over it," said Ishmael. "Getting over it isn't possible."
"It didn't stop him from living," his mother insisted. "He went right on with his life. He didn't let self-pity overwhelm him. He just kept on with things."
"I've kept on," said Ishmael. "I've kept his newspaper going, haven't I?
That isn't what I mean," his mother said. "That isn't what I'm getting at. You know as well as I do what I'm trying to say. Why on earth don't you go out with someone? How can you stand your loneliness? You're an attractive man. There are a lot of women who..."
"Let's not go over all of this again," said Ishmael, putting down his spoon. "Let's talk about something else."
"For you, what else is there?" said his mother.
when it comes down to it, to answer your question, here's what you should do about being unhappy. You should get married and have some children.
That isn't going to happen, said Ishmael. That's not the answer to the question.
Yes, it is, said his mother. It genuinely, surely is.
After dinner, he lit the kerosene heater and put it in her bedroom. His parents' grandfather clock still ticked away after all these years with a maniacal endurance. It reminded him now of Saturday mornings when his father would read to him under the sheets with the clock thundering in the background. They'd read Ivanhoe together, taking turns, and then David Copperfield. Now he saw in his flashlight beam his mother slept under eiderdown quilts that were just beginning to yellow. He was surprised to find beside her bed the antique RCA turntable that had, until recently, resided in his father's old study. She'd been listening to Mozart's Jupiter Symphony, as performed by the Vienna Symphony Orchestra in 1947. And Ishmael, seeing it on the turntable, imagined her in bed with that melancholy music playing and a cup of tea beside her. He imagined her with the Mozart on at 9 o'clock at night. He opened the taps in the sink and bathtub and went out to check on her chickens. There were 12 of them, all Rhode Island Reds, huddled into a ball at one end of the chicken house his father had built years before. For a moment, Ishmael caught them in the beam of his flashlight. Then he reached in and took up a nearby egg left untended in the cold. It was hard to the touch, and he knew that inside, the embryo was solidly frozen. He warmed it for a moment in the palm of his hand, then rolled it gently in the direction of the chickens. They rearranged themselves in the face of this, panicking and fluttering just a little. He went back in and, still wearing his coat and hat, wandered through the rooms of the cold house. His breath came forth in jets of fog and disappeared into the darkness. Ishmael put his hand on the newel post at the bottom of the stairway, then removed it and shone the flashlight beam upward. Shallow moons had been worn into the risers. The banister, he saw, had lost its luster. Upstairs, the room he'd slept in as a boy had been converted by his mother into a place to sew and iron and to store her clothes. Ishmael went up, and sitting on his old bed, tried to remember how it had once been. He recollected that on a good day in winter, when the maple trees stood bare, he could look through his dormer window out beyond the trees and see the green salt water to the southwest. He'd had a button and a pennant collection. 1,000 pennies in a large mason jar, a fishbowl, and a model tin Lizzie hung from a strand of wire in one corner. He'd kept his glass underwater box in the corner of the closet, his mitt on top of it. On certain nights, the moonlight had flooded through his dormer window and bathed everything in blue, beguiling shadows that prevented him from sleeping. He'd sit up listening to crickets and frogs, and on some nights to the radio at his bedside. He'd listened mostly to baseball games, the Seattle Rainiers of the Pacific Coast League, and he could still remember the voice of Leo Lassen, barely audible beyond a field of static. White leads off first, dancing, dancing, ready to break. He's driving Gittleson absolutely crazy. Strange is at the plate now after taking his practice cuts. Baby, hear this fine crowd on hand at 6th Stadium greet Strange as he digs in. He's a real favorite, isn't he? Oh, you should be here tonight. Mount Rainier is out beyond the right field fence, looming up like a great big ice cream cone. Gittleson is into his windup now. And there goes White. No time for a throw. White is standing up. Safe at second base. Who? Boy, White is safe. He's stolen second base. White is safe at second base. His father, too, had liked baseball. Ishmael had sat with him by the Bendicks in the living room, and they had both been mesmerized by the urgency Leo Lassen imparted to a battle so many miles away in Seattle, Portland, or Sacramento. The voice from the radio
It had dropped an octave, altered pitch, slowed and lengthened measurably, was now that of someone's wayward uncle confiding the secrets of his golf game. Now it miraculously glided through a tongue twister. Now it suddenly sensed great depths of meaning in an ordinary double play. Arthur would slam the armrest of his chair in satisfaction at a fortunate turn of events. He was saddened when errors in judgment or carelessness cast the team into a hole. At lulls in the game, he would stretch his legs out, twine his hands across his lap, and stare at the radio as it spoke to him. Eventually, he slept, with his head lolled forward, and stayed that way until Leo Lassen went shrill again in ecstasy about the game. Freddie Mueller had hit a double. Ishmael remembered his father half asleep. The crescent of warm light thrown by the table lamp containing only his figure, that of the radio, and the turned-back pages of a magazine in his lap. Harper's or Scientific Agriculture. By the late innings of the game, the rest of the room, a few laggard coals glowed orange beneath the fireplace grate, lay sleeping in soft, quiescent shadows. Coats hung from polished brass hooks in the foyer, and his father's books, arranged by size, stood neatly along the glassed-in shelves of two vault-like oak bookcases. When something momentous came to pass, a home run, a stolen base, a double play, a run batted in, his father would stir, blink two or three times, and by dint of habit bring his hand to rest on the spectacles sitting atop his magazine. His hair lay close to his skull in gray twists, and his chin tilted slightly heavenward. Gray hairs sprouted from his ears and nostrils, and more straggled forth from his eyebrows. When the game was over, he would shut off the radio and fix his spectacles carefully in place by curling their stems behind his ears. They were antique steel full moons, and when he put them on, he invariably underwent a quiet transformation, becoming suddenly professorial, handsome in the way that some outdoorsmen are yet scholarly at the same time. He would pick up his magazine and begin to read as if the game had never happened. Ishmael's father had died in Seattle at the Veterans Administration Hospital. He'd had cancer of the pancreas and, in the end, of the liver. And Ishmael had not been there at the final moment. 170 islanders turned out for Arthur's funeral, which was held on a warm, cloudless day in June at the San Pietro Memorial Cemetery. Masato Nagaishi, Ishmael recalled, had presented himself in the funeral's aftermath to offer condolences on behalf of the Japanese American Citizens League and the Japanese Community Center. "I wish to say," said Masato Nagaishi, "that the Japanese people of San Pietro Island are saddened by the death of your father. We have always had great respect for him as a newspaper man and as a neighbor, a man of great fairness and compassion for others, a friend to us and to all people." Masato Nagaishi took Ishmael's hand and gripped it in his own tightly. He was a large man with a broad face and no hair on his head, and he blinked often behind his spectacles. "We know you will follow in your father's footsteps," Mr. Nagaishi said forcefully, shaking Ishmael's hand. "We are certain you will honor his legacy. For now, like you, we are all sad. We mourn with you and honor your father. We think of you in your grief."
This ends Disc 10. Disc